Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
On today's podcast, author A.W. Hammond joins me to discuss his new thriller, The Berlin Trader. My name is Justin Hamilton, and I can't wait to tell you more about my novel, Jack Reacharound, The Dubbo Detective, here on Big Squid. Hello and welcome to a special episode of Big Squid. We are between seasons, but I am a big fan of A.W. Hammond, my good friend Alex, who is a wonderful writer, and especially his last two books, The Paris Collaborator and his new novel, The Berlin Trader. Fantastic reads, absolute unputdownable thrillers. Unputdownable? Anyway, it's been a long week. I'm recording this on a Friday, but you know what I mean. It's a cracking book, and I was really keen to have him on the podcast and discuss it. And hopefully, if you haven't read either of his books, maybe inspire you to go and check them out as well. Two quick things. I want longtime Big Squid listeners to really give me some props. I really want some respect from you, because there's a point where Alex mentions Jack Reacher, and I make no Jack Reacharound jokes. And it was hard. It was really hard. I figured he wouldn't know what I was talking about. So I held off, and I put that joke in the intro. So, as I said, I don't ask for much. But just really give me two thumbs up for my restraint at not being childish at that moment when he mentions Jack Reacher in a very innocent moment of discussion. Also, in the interview, Alex tries to remember a novel by Scott Lynch, and he draws a blank. And then, classic podcasting, 2 minutes after we stop recording, he sends me a text message saying, I've remembered what the book is, and it's The Republic of Thieves. So now, when we get to that point in the interview, and we're quite clearly flailing around, you'll know exactly what it is we were searching for. But anyway, it's a fun little moment, and you'll know what the book is. I'll pop by at the end, but now let's bring in Alex to discuss his wonderful book, The Berlin Trader. So we are recording this the day after Michael Gambon passed away, and I don't know about you, because we're, you know, similar of age. My introduction to him was Dennis Potters, the singing detective, back in the 80s, and that was a TV series that had a huge influence on me, because I just, at that point in my life, never seen anything like it, where it was a kitchen sink drama, but it was the detective story, and it was a story about a man, you know, trapped in his own skin condition, hallucinating,
yes,
getting the real world confused with what was going on. And I was wondering, as a detective fan, had you ever seen that series?
I have, but my memory is hazy on it. For that one, I think the one that was influential for me from the 80s was now that you've asked me, I've gone, oh, what is it from the 80s that was influential? Was the environmental thriller with about nuclear reactors.
Edge of Darkness.
There yes. we go. I knew I'd get there with the Eric Clapton soundtrack, guitars yes. raging over. Yeah.
Back when we felt like we could like Eric Clapton. Before he started yeah. saying all his political thoughts, and you're like, "Oh, Eric, just keep playing guitar, mate."
Yeah, but that was yeah. So, but I do remember particularly the surreal sort of, you know, the hallucinations from that, and also the skin condition. I just hadn't seen anything like that before. Like, it was really distressing, and yeah, there was a sort of humanistic element to it too. That was, I think. And that you've made reference to, like in the terms of the kitchen sink drama side of it, but it felt very real, you know, at
yes.
the same time.
Yeah. It also was very funny too. So I'd never really seen
yeah.
something that, like the Gambon skin condition, as you said, is quite confronting and,
yes.
You know, depicted in a very honest kind of way. But then you kind of had the two patients who were like an English-Greek chorus who were discussing what was going on, and characters going from the real world to the hallucination and backwards and forwards. I recently rewatched it. You can find all of the episodes on YouTube, and was absolutely chuffed to find that it still holds up.
I should give it a revisit. Yeah, because as I said, very hazy on my memory on it, but yeah. Gambon, yeah. I mean, obviously, most people know him from Harry Potter, but I don't know if you've ever saw Layer Cake.
Yes, a long time ago,
But he was great in that because he kind of brought that kind of gravitas and sort of, because he was Irish, right, I think. I don't know, but he had that. He sort of had that very plum in English accent.
Yeah,
but it's a crime thriller. It's an English crime thriller, but he brings a kind of plumminess, but then to a sort of street edge to the character, to it, and he's quite memorable in that as well.
Yeah, one of those ones where you look and you see his age, and you go, "Oh, like 82. That's a good innings," but you're still bummed out at the same time. What was your introduction to the world of detective stories? Was it Edge of Darkness, or was it before that?
I think filmically would have been Edge of Darkness, definitely.
Yeah.
But then, and also the bleak 80s of Thatcherite Britain, I think,
yes.
too, sort of influenced me in that respect. But for me, too, was Poe, Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah.
For the short stories, you know, he wrote those series there, and I referenced that in the sense of Duchenne being named after Dupin, who's Poe's detective. And then also I think Chandler early on. So that's one of the other influences there, sort of from the pulp side of things. But very quickly, I think in terms of like the most influential for me as a thriller was, and we may have spoken about this before previously, Silence of the Lambs. That's the thing that made me think, oh man, I would love to write a good thriller. And I don't even think I'm close to the genius of that novel, and it's absolutely worth a read. For I mean, lots of people have seen the film, obviously very famous, won heaps of Academy Awards, right? But as a novel, it's just the structure and the way that language is used in it is so precise. It's remarkable. It's a remarkable what Thomas Harris is able to do with that book. So that was the one that made me really aspire to try to write thrillers. Crime thrillers.
Well, you know, yeah. I feel like your latest book, The Berlin Trader, is your best yet. And I read it in one plane sitting, which is kind of on my way over to South Korea. And I thought, I'll read a little bit of it on the way over. I'll read a little bit of it while I'm over there. I'll read a little bit of it on the way back. And once I landed in South Korea, I was like, oh, I'm going to have to find another book. It's the first question I have to ask you, though, your main character of August Duchenne, why do you hate him? Because that opening chapter, I was reading it like thinking, man, this is a brutal opening to a character that I already have affection for from your previous book, The Paris Collaborator.
Oh, well, look, first off, thank you. Thanks for saying that about the book. Yeah, it's you always put something out there and personally, I try to, you know, love to feel that it's, you know, improving every time, but it's always great to hear that. I guess it's the Chandler thing I referenced, right? Like, yeah. I kind of come from that idea that to make it interesting, you really want to put the character through the ringer and have them, you know, and at the same time, I want to write an interesting first chapter that sort of really pushes people into the world and immediately sort of says to them, hey, pay attention, you know, some stuff's going to happen here. Yeah, but it's that noir, hard-boiled where a character's constantly getting beaten up and things happen to them, all the time, nonstop. I mean, a great example of which also, like, if crossing across the film is Miller's Crossing. Gabriel Byrne's character just is constantly being beaten up by everybody.
Yeah, like including his love interest.
Yeah, everybody beats him up. He can't catch a break. He's caught between two, you know, the warring crime families, and everybody beats him up the whole time. Yeah. Then also Chinatown starts with that great, you know, sequence where I think it's even Roman Polanski in the book, controversially, sorry everybody, but playing the sort of street thugs that cuts the nose of Jack Nicholson's character, you know.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, that's sort of what I'm trying to do, is just sort of establish very rapidly the vulnerability of the character too, and make us feel like from the outset that there's threats to them and that anything could happen.
Well, that's a really interesting thing that you bring up, because you know, I love The Paris Collaborator, but because August went through so much, I got to the end of that book and was like, oh, well, his story is done. You know, like, it felt like a complete story, because he takes a beating in that as well. And I'm curious to know, when did you realize that you had more stories for this character? Because I was rapt to come back into his world and be with him. So was that a plan all along, or was that somewhere in the writing that you went, there's further places to go?
I think so. Part of this is like kind of, I've written before, right? So I wrote these earlier books that were sort of Melbourne legal thrillers, and I had a, you know, I was very inspired by The Wire at that point, you know, David Simon. I thought that was all amazing, and I wanted to tell this big grand tale of like five books, but the realities and the commercial realities of publishing is that sometimes that stuff doesn't play out. So, and that was, you know, a bit demoralizing, right? So I did come to writing The Paris Collaborator with this idea of what can I write that's a standalone? And it was, that was very much inspired by the setting and this idea of the German occupation of Paris and what would it like to be a kind of detective character in that setting when you're in an occupied city. But as I was writing it, I sort of realized, well, it would be nice to do maybe something else, but I didn't want to overcommit that idea because it is, you know, as you know, as a creative, when you work on something and then, you know, for whatever reasons, often the commercial reasons, you know, it doesn't come to light, it can be tough. So, I didn't want to give myself this of some thinking that far ahead. So I sort of thought post-war Berlin was an interesting setting, again, from that kind of conundrum of how do you take a detective and make things difficult for them? Yeah. And a city that's completely decimated and bombed out is one way to do it, because there's no street signs. Everybody's moved from their houses. How do you find a missing person in that environment? So a little bit I had an idea that might be something worth doing. But then, like I said, I didn't want to commit. I thought, if this is the last you know, book of mine that I ever write that I ever get published, then it's nice to have it stand alone as well.
Yeah.
But you can see in the first book, I did seed some of a little, just a yes. touch here, so that if I was going to go down that route, there was reward for a reader who's read the first book. But then with the second book, I also tried really hard to also make that stand alone if you hadn't read the first one. So sort of trying to be a lot more pragmatic in the way that I approach these books. Yeah.
Well, the way I've been promoting it to the listeners of the podcast has been, if you haven't read the first one, you can read this one, and then you can go back and find out how we got here. And I don't think there is the order. Like, of course, it's better to go Paris to Berlin, as it were, but I don't think you have to.
Yes. Yeah. No. And that's very deliberate. That's very deliberate. To try to, So that, as I said, if you've read the other one, it's a little bit rewarding in the sense that obviously you feel more familiar with the character, but there aren't that many characters that are moving across from the previous book. It's not all based on events that happened previously. They're lightly referenced. You can pick up the second book without knowing anything and still get something out of it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, words like Easter eggs and continuity have almost become words that you want to avoid, but it's all there. It's all there, and you can pick up on it as you're reading. I love Duchenne. I think he's a really interesting character, but one of the things that and I can't remember if I mentioned this with the Paris collaborator, but it feels even more so because of the years that have passed in this latest novel, is that he is physically past his prime. Like, he is not an action hero. He gets hurt, like he's limping around in this, you know. It's fascinating when he comes up against new male characters, and those male characters are often quite imposing in comparison to him. And I'm interested to know what made you to decide to impose those physical limitations on him rather than have him in his prime.
Yeah, I think some of that is the nature of, I guess, historical fiction. So if I wanted to make a character that fought in the First World War, he has to be of a certain age, right? So that was part of it, and building out his character as a sort of, you know, a survivor of that war and putting that into his backstory. So he can only be of a certain age. But then I thought I'd play up his that side of it, again, to sort of show the vulnerability of the character, I guess. Mm. You know, in some ways I'm trying to do these sort of humanistic thrillers that are less about, that are a bit more about what people are like and their relationships and their internal worlds, in as much as they're about being an action hero or somebody who's, you know, competent physically. And so it's not a Jack Reacher character in any stretch of the imagination, right? You know, no disrespect, but I couldn't imagine anything worse than having this sort of, you know, what are they called, Mary Sue characters who can do everything.
Yeah,
you know. And that's again to make us identify with him a little bit, maybe as, you know, I don't know, am I past my prime? that was part of it, that vulnerability. But also it's more interesting to tell stories, I think, when some things that could seem like easily overcome under certain circumstances can provide a challenge to a character, and we know more clearly what's at stake for somebody like Duchenne. So if he does get injured, it's not just a simple case of, you know, he just keeps on going. It's going to provide and prove a problem for him. There's certain ways he's, you know, even just down to the fundamental basics of how does he get in and out of places, you know, like something I could easily just, you know, climb the wall or whatever, but not necessarily for him. So without it being a sort of problem. So it's coming at it to make him relatable, but also, again, back to that whole sort of hard-boiled kind of put your characters through the ringer. So it just gives me more opportunities to do that.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of... Sorry, go on.
No. I was just going to say, there's a lot of, like, as a writer, you look for ways to have different ways of coming in at something from a sort of technical level. I'm always trying to think of, oh, what's a way to make the scene a slightly more interesting or different to the last one, or you know, add variety into the way that you're building description and action.
Also, he's a character that seems like he's more respected than liked as well, and I always feel a little bit sorry for him, like, and I think that's a bit of a classic detective thing as well, isn't it, where it's like, he's been compromised in so many ways, yes. And he's actually done his best. And it's almost like so many people don't respect him for just, you know, often putting a situation ahead of what would be easier for him.
Yeah, that's a great insight, actually. Yeah, I've never really thought about it that way, but you're quite right. Like, he's got the skills that people want, but because of how he's been asked to employ those skills previously, and
yeah,
people don't necessarily like him for that. Mm.
Yeah, he's. Do you ever get to a point where you're thinking, oh man, I should. If only he was 6 years younger, he could climb this wall. Or
no, it's a fun part about it. I enjoy that part about it. It's almost like the I mean, some of the challenges too is like when you have limitations, it kind of makes it easier to write. Like I can't tell you, like writing something that's set when there are no mobile phones makes life so much easier, because when I do write contemporary fiction, it's always that's the question. Why don't I just pick up the phone and call so and so and
right.
You know, and you don't want to be that, you know, I'm sure you've seen that supercut on YouTube of all the times the phone's out of reception. I hate it when people do that. It's the weakest thing in the world. So So it's just the limitations make for actually ease the way of writing, because you're more confined in terms of, so not every idea can come forward. So yeah.
That's the two things. One is the only time I've ever really enjoyed the phone being out of reception is in Hot Fuzz, and they use the reception diminishing on the train trip to show you how far out is, and it's because it's done so far in advance. You go, okay, I see what you're doing, but you're doing this in a creative way, so that works for me.
Yeah, oh, and Edgar Wright's such a fantastic visual storyteller too.
Yeah,
you know, it just tells the story really simply. That yeah. He's moving away from London. Yeah, yeah. And, great film, Hot Fuzz.
And the film Zodiac, a friend of mine, Adam Richard, he finds that a frustrating film because there's actually no denouement at the end. And because it frustrates him so much, he always says, well, if they had mobile phones, this thing would have been solved and I wouldn't have had to sit through it.
That's funny. Yeah.
That's the point.
Yeah.
So I had a question for you, and then I was telling you earlier that I caught up with your sister Claire in Sydney, and she brought this up as well. So I'll let this be Claire's question. But the book is split between two timelines of 1936 and 1945. I'm curious to know what inspired you to break the story up like this, and what Claire wanted to know is how do you write that? Do you write one timeline and then write the other, or do you bounce back and forward between it? How do you put that together?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, I think, in terms of it sort of touches on a couple of elements. Some of them are like the technical part of the writing, but then part of it is also around character. So the 1936 timeline is really there to sort of show the relationship between Duchenne and his wife, Sabine, in many ways, but also start to show him as the sort of first time he's doing this sort of, I'm using air quotes here, but detective work.
Yeah.
And then 45 is the, for want of a better word, the current timeline from the previous books, but where the action is happening, you know, in the moment for him. Yeah, so they're not essentially flashbacks because there's more time given to the 1936 stuff, but it lets us see sort of Duchenne pre-war, when he was a teacher with his family, what that was like, but also kind of lets me play around with the idea of this sort of rise of ideology, which is part of what the Berlin Trade is all about. It sort of looks at, you know, communism and fascism and capitalism, you know, and what the way that influences countries, right? And we as readers know the outcomes of this sort of thing, so already, because you know we're aware of history, where the way that the war ends, we're aware of things like the Cold War. So it let me sort of show the foundations of those ideas. So when you jump forward to 1945, where really things have hit off. I mean, we've got the Spanish Civil War going on in 36, but really the Second World War has now been done, and also 45, it's post-war in Europe, so we can see the outcome again, for want of a better word. But I really wanted to play around that with that idea of the beginning of the Cold War. So I really wanted to firmly establish what this was like, this sort of 1936 with people being members of the Communist Party, you know, and that being seen as a sort of a, for many people, a valid way of considering a direction the world could go in. But then from a sort of technical level as for the readers, I wanted to have a way so I could say, reassure people, like, we're actually, because we're going back to 1936, it's almost like we're starting afresh with these characters, you know. We're establishing what Duchenne was like. We're establishing his relationship with his daughter. We're establishing his relationship with his wife. We're seeing in some ways sort of the beginnings of this character. So if you pick this book up, you're not really missing too much by not having read the one previously. So, and it was sort of like there's a writer, a fantasy author, one of my favorite fantasy authors, but he's not very prolific, unfortunately. His name's Scott Lynch, and he wrote this book called, it was his third film, Thorns. I can't remember what it's called exactly, but in that one, he tells it across two timelines, sort of showing these characters as children and characters as the adults. So I wanted to use a similar. I thought, oh, that's a good idea to sort of do cross two timelines, but really invest time in both, so that it's not like a flashback and you're just doing a page here or whatever. So that's where it was inspired by.
Was that the Thorn of Emberlane? Is that what you were?
No, that's going to be the fourth one. Sorry. Yeah, I've got it's downstairs on my bookshelf. If I was there, I'd just glance across.
It'll pop into your head when you least expect it. I'll get a text message at 3 a.m. Here it is.
Yeah.
So when you were writing them, did you write one part of the story and then write the next?
Oh, yeah, sorry. The second part of the question.
Sorry, it was a big question.
Well, I plot. No, it's all right. So I plot. What I do is I'm a big believer in plotting the entire book out, right?
Right.
And in some cases, that's almost like, you know, and the way I do it is a sort of not quite cut ups, you know, which is that sort of creative process, and Bowie used it. But, you know, you take ideas and you put them all into a bag and then pull them out and see what you got, right? Mm. This is more structured than that. I know I've got plot A and plot B and character arc A and character arc B, and I write those out sequentially in my plotting, and then I can feed them in on a big piece of cardboard, you know, my little squares of paper, and say, oh, when would it make the most sense to put that bit? When would it make? So I know that once you get to the end of it, we've told the full story and moved between the two timelines and filled in our character moments and really sort of established their motivations. And then I can sit down and confidently write and not get stuck in that bit where you stop and I don't know what I'm going to do next, you know? And I feel that really aids, particularly when you're writing something that's has a detective mystery element to it, where you've got to feed out the clues and ask questions of and pose new questions to the reader as others are answered, you know. So I structure it, but then I write it sequentially.
And then within the writing process, does anything kind of happen that takes you by surprise? Does a character just where you think they're going to end up, you suddenly get about two-thirds of the way through and go, oh, no, their ending is going to be completely different?
Yes. It's more in the smaller actions and the sort of character moments that you then sort of have an idea. So I have the big beats, you know, that I want to do. Like, oh, I want to have this bit and it's going to be a meeting and it's going to be, you know, significant for these two characters. But then what actually happens in that moment, I haven't written that out. So I then sort of have these revelations about the characters as I'm sort of sitting there and, you know, coming up with the dialogue between them as they, you know, talking to one another. Or I realize that a character in this book, no, this is not a spoiler, but there's like sort of the US Army soldier ends up driving them all around Berlin. And I realize that I want to do more with that character as I'm writing it, because I think that they're a really interesting way to sort of draw out aspects of other characters and introduce sort of perspectives on the overarching kind of setting. And so you go, oh, actually, I'm going to put them in more chapters, you know, but they're not a sort of critical linchpin to the whole story that you know. So, and that stuff I really find enjoyable, because you need the spontaneity. Like, having structured it, it would just be really not fun to then... I think it's James Ellroy used to write his structures were longer than the books themselves.
Right.
So he'd plot it.
Right.
And it's almost like he was editing and writing more creatively to produce that. And his books, some of them are fat. Like American Tabloid, it's like 500 500 pages. So he's written more than that in his instruction and wow. notes to himself. It's just like, I don't know how somebody can do that. Like, it feels hard, like really hard. Yeah. Not to say that there aren't challenges in writing, and it's definitely, but that feels like really making things hard for yourself.
Yeah, some things are, you know, you admire them, and you also know instinctively, that is not for me. For anyone who enjoyed Oppenheimer, this book actually kind of touches on stuff that's going on at the same time, even going back as far as 1936 and the Spanish War. There's mentions in that film about funneling money. Communism was seen as a legitimate political choice for a certain while there, and it's interesting in this, especially in that 1936 era with Duchenne and his wife Sabine, they have very different attitudes towards war and fighting, and in a way Duchenne feels quite modern in his regard to war and the effect it has on people. And you know, in your research, was that a trait that you found that came from some people who had already fought in World War One, or was that something that you just figured that's how he would look at the world?
Yeah, it's an astute question. I think it's a bit of both for me, right? Because I know that people who, I mean, we don't have the language for this, like survivors of the First World War often had post-traumatic stress disorder, yeah, right? Like, and they, you know, so he's seen things and witnessed things that, you know, are horrific. But it is, I think, a bit of a modern anachronism for him to be. And there were pacifists around. Like, we know in the 30s there were ideologies that were around. But essentially he's not a card-carrying pacifist, but I thought, oh, if I kind of map, that's his response to how he's trying to process that war. I mean, I think there's interesting questions and possibly to be explored in future books around how he deals with that ordeal, right? Because if we were to take a very modern lens to it, to him as a character, we never really see too much of his internal world around surviving the First World War and how that's influenced his psyche. I focus more on it rather the way that he's resolved to not, you know, re-enlist or to... So at the very beginning of the book, he's approached by the Allies and they ask him if he'll re-enlist.
Yeah.
And he says no, but they find a way for him to still keep working with them, essentially. But also, you know, why he's not the kind of character, the first thing he does arrive in Berlin is, you know, says, where's my revolver or my pistol or whatever, you know. And, that's what I sort of, wanted to have him be that. So he's also, again, to us, because if you're going to have in the first book, right, where he's forced to work for the Germans, and he's also, you know, working for the resistance, and both situations sort of compelled to work for them, you could think, well, this guy doesn't have any values. So the values that he exhibits are these other sort of higher values, but more sort of values around violence and war, you know, which perhaps are a little bit more modern, but I thought that was okay. I didn't think that was too much of a stretch for people. Although I will get contacted by people and over email, and they will hammer me about historical accuracy.
Oh, do they write? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't write back because a lot of time they're wrong. They're finding weird connections of their own. But then sometimes they're right. And the beauty of having the Berlin Trader come out is that the Paris Collaborator has also been re-released in a little paperback version.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Which is kind of cool because I've always wanted to have a sort of little in the back pocket kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, right. Oh, that's great. Yeah. Nice cover, too.
So I'll shoot you over a copy just so you can see, but it's it ties in with the other cover, but in having that come out, then I could just tweak one thing that was really bugging me about something that was historically inaccurate in that book.
Because I was going to ask you if there was anything that decisions you made in the first book that you know, when you're writing the character now that you look back and you go, God damn it. But it was just a mild inaccuracy, was it?
In that one, there was an inaccuracy. There wasn't too much I would do differently. Like maybe with the benefit of hindsight, I might have built out a bit more with some of the Gestapo characters just to sort of, you were talking about Easter eggs before, just as a little Easter egg for somebody who'd read the first book, if they cared to, you know, remember that character to make it a little bit more, you know. So in the course of the story, they catch up with a few of these Gestapo guys, but in the Berlin Trader. But it would have been good to sort of make them a bit more identifiable as characters from the previous book. Other than that, I was pretty happy with it. I mean, it's always interesting too, because I was working with a separate editor for...
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
For the re-edit of the Paris Collaborator and a few things around, like, again, just language of the time. So there was a little bit of a polite discussion, you know, I wouldn't even go so far as to say a debate, but a little polite disagreement over there is a reference from a character in the Paris Collaborator, and it's one of the few times that the Holocaust is brought up, not because it didn't happen and not because I'm a Holocaust denier, but yeah, because I feel like that's such a delicate and something that needs to be given proper time to really unpack and engage with. It would probably be something that we'd grapple with if I was to write a third in this series. Didn't want to just move through it too quickly and not give it the proper attention. But at the same time, I thought I don't want to not mention it at all, because that's almost worse. So a character refers to them rounding up Jews and gypsies. And I was asked if I would consider making that change to Roma or Romani. But in 1944, even, you know, a character, would they know, would they be that respectful of the fact that gypsies is a, you know, derogatory term? And so I figured it was okay to sort of carry that forwards. But it's kind of interesting, the sorts of, when we're talking about historical accuracy, and, you know, that would have tilted it outside of historical accuracy, you know. So it's always interesting, those sorts of questions, I think.
I don't know if this is correct, but for me, if language is pertinent, then it should be in there. I sometimes wonder if it's worthwhile putting, you don't want to get into censorship, but little things at the start, which is, you know, hey, sometimes people will use language that you might find confronting, but this is the language of the era. And please read in context. You know, it's not it's not you calling someone a gypsy. It's that's the word.
That's a great point. That's a really good idea. I notice sometimes you see on some of the sort of journalist channels on YouTube, they'll sometimes do that, because they'll have quotes from the period, right?
But
and they'd say, heads up, there's going to be some language in this. It's contextual, but some people might find it offensive. Now, I'd also think you don't hammer the point. You don't have everybody running around using profane, you know, distressing language, just enough to get it and then move forward. It's not every second word is,
There's a line between using the correct word and also being childish.
Yeah, yeah.
And using it too much.
Deliberately provocative, you know, like,
I remember there was an episode of Mad Men where they go over to Roger's place and he's putting on a party, and he comes out with his new bride who's way too young for him, and he performs in blackface. And there was talk about, oh, you have to edit that out. And it's like, but when you watch the episode, it's really embarrassing. Also, it's a character that you like, but he would have done something like that. And also within the scene, you have the younger, more progressive ad people incredibly embarrassed and not knowing what to do because he's the boss. And I feel like that's the commentary, and that's why you keep the scene.
100%. I mean, that was almost a big part of what Mad Men was about, right? Like the shift, you know, cultural changes and the way that people behave, even through to like those bits where kids were constantly being like beaten by their parents or whatever, like in the role of you know, that's, yeah. No, I think it's, that's the essence of the show. I mean, it is.
Yeah.
And that's why, I don't know, you're getting the whole sidetrack here, but like context is critical, right? Like comedians often talk about like, well, if you had to be there for that. You take one joke out of context in a comedy show. You haven't been there for the setup. Yeah. You don't know that it's a callback. You don't know the preceding, you know, humorous anecdote stories that I was telling that led up to this. And then it all, I mean, as well, you know, right? So, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, and people, you know, I consider myself a small little L liberal, but it's, if you become militant, what you do is you empower the childish sides of the conservative right to then go even further. Do you know what I mean? So when people get too on the nose about things, then the natural thing to have happen is to have a repellent force against it, and then that's when you get people actually dialing back all the progress that's made by making horrific jokes or using horrific language with no context, and it's just to make a very simple point. And it's I find all of that stuff really frustrating.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah.
You know, you're just fueling them. So don't give them any extra fuel. I love that the book's set in Berlin. And did you know that you were going, and it's such an interesting time as well in as you said, like it's a mess of a city. There's no street signs, etc. Did you know that's where you were going to go, or was there something else that drew you to that period?
Yes, in many ways, I thought as I was writing The Paris Collaborator, Berlin would be an interesting place to set another one. And it was a very lightly held idea because, again, I didn't want to, upset myself by working out an entire plot and then not getting to write the next one. But because in some ways it was also defined for me in that I was writing this series of books, but where the city is a character almost. So like in the Paris Collaborator, we've got, the Germans are treating Paris as their recreation hub for, in the middle of the war. The Parisians are having to live with all these Germans just as for hanging out. And there's this sort of, we really want to evoke the setting there. So then it was like, well, that feels like a strong theme across all the books. Like, what's an interesting city to set these things in? So Berlin jumped out at me just because of that. There's this, and I have the benefit in many ways of this fantastic, footage. So if I was writing something set in the 16th century, I would, you're going to written texts.
Yeah.
There's not the benefit of photography. Paintings are obviously a lot of the times, propaganda or, pieces. They're not necessarily realistic. I mean, not to say that photos and film can't be propaganda, but it also gives you a sense of like the time, right? Like, and I'd seen these flyovers that the Allies took after they came into Berlin in black and white of the city, and it's just devastated, right? And then I thought, because I like to write these stories about civilians, and that's my sort of that humanistic thrillers is going, well, how can we write about the stories around civilians and tell the civilian side of war, which is very much what the Paris Collaborator was doing. But this one, then I was like, Berlin is great for that, because I knew lightly from history that obviously the Soviets, the Russians had come in and bombed the hell out of the place, And we see that being repeated again in Ukraine, right? So it's just shell, and leave nothing, lay everything to waste and then roll in. And there was there's a book that I then read, which was a first person diary account written by a journalist. She wrote it anonymously. People know who this person was after she passed away. They figured out who it was. But it's called A Woman in Berlin, and it's about the experience of a woman in Berlin surviving when the Soviets came in, and was not pretty, but it gives you some very key little insights, and it's building off that where I get these ideas. So like in the book, there's a bit where they go to a doctor, and the doctor's using the x-ray x-rays as windows, because all the windows have been shattered. So to create a sort of semi-sterile environment, they put all these x-rays up. And I thought, that's just so visually fascinating. Yeah. It actually happened. You know, they'd gone to visit doctor, she talks about this. So I thought, got to put that in the book, right? So I start at the sort of quite literally at the helicopter level of seeing the bombed out city, but then move into the sort of first-hand accounts and able to build it that way. And I knew less about it than Occupy Paris. Not that I'm an expert on Occupy Paris, but and it was fascinating to research. And after a while, I had to Bernie, my wife. I said, she was probably getting sick of all my terrible, you know, the terrible sort of capability of humanity to be awful to itself. But I had to stop. I had to stop the research after a certain draw line in the sand, because I was getting too overwhelmed with, you know, with everything. So
I hope you were a history nerd in school, so it was easy to segue into it, because there has to be so much research to get all of this as accurate as possible.
Yeah, more in uni, I think, and I did a little bit in high school, but I was, you know, I was more into my fantasy books, you know, then and science fiction and stuff. But it's a good grounding, I think, for if you're going to write. And I still try to read fairly broadly, right? But I think fantasy, for the most part, science fiction less so, but it depends on the writer, actually, to be fair. But that's about world building, and it's sort of you learn so much from that. But uni is where I came to it more. And then, you know, like, I had the benefit of fortunately being able to, well, being subjected to a law degree, and you learn very research quickly and wade your way through dry stuff. And so that's those soft skills that I got out of uni is really how I'm able to do it. But I find it genuinely interesting. Like, absolutely. You know, it's fun to pick a point in history and try to really burrow down and find out interesting little facts. The challenge then is not to just make your book, all the facts I learned, you know, and like, you know, just a brain dump onto the reader, and, you know,
I have read those books.
<you're> like, so have I.
And you're like, hang on a sec, wasn't this meant to be a thriller? No. Yeah. You know, they always say you should never judge a book by its cover, but I've got to be honest, your covers are fantastic. With the artist, it's Deborah Bilson. Do you have any contact with Deborah beforehand, or does Deborah read your book, or how do you come up with these images?
So I basically send the publishers send a brief through to her. I don't believe she read it. I know they share the manuscript, so they can sort of dip in and get a few ideas. It's possible. I did reach out to her after I'd seen the covers, and after we were sort of, it had been published over, and, you know, tagged her in on Instagram and struck up a bit of a conversation with her there. So that was lovely. What I do get is they show me, and this one more so than sometimes others, they gave like four options. So she'd done up four possible covers for the Berlin Trader, capturing various different aspects of the book. And then along with the publisher, I kind of work through with them which one we think is the one to go with. And I give sort of then a little bit of fine-tuning feedback on that cover. And mostly that's around, again, I'm not a history sort of expert or scholar, but you can sometimes pick up on things that are slightly not quite historically accurate in the cover. Certainly when it comes to the Second World War, like, I know people, obviously there's people who really can name the planes and name the tanks and all that, so I'm not one of those people, but and I was enough on the first cover of the Paris Collaborator to realize that the planes flying overhead were German, and they wouldn't have had Air Force. Were Allied planes, and they wouldn't be flying over at that point. But in this one, the Berlin Trader, we put the Reichstag in it, you know, just to make sure it was a sort of identifiable sort of monument. So I gave a little bits of feedback like that. And then there's it's a great process to go through. It's always exciting to see the covers. It's always that interesting thing. It's in the contract with any writer, the cover is the sort of at the decision of the publisher. But most publishers are fantastic in that they bring you in and want to engage in the conversation with you about it. So it's not like they go, well, we'll decide and we'll tell you what it is. But you can imagine there might be some difficult writers out there. And interestingly, the title of the book is counted as being part of the cover. So the author doesn't get to determine the title. But in this case I did, because they'd come up with the Paris Collaborator for the first one, which I thought was a fantastic title, and then so it was just a case of like building off that structure. So it was the, you know, the Berlin Trader. made sense, picked up from where the other one was. And we can ask the same question in the Paris Collaborators, all these ideas around what collaboration means, and in the Berlin Traders, all these ideas around what you're traded to, your own ideology, or traded to your nation, you know, who defines, like, you don't really define whether you're a trader or not, right? It's usually like, well, you were born in this country and now you've made a decision to disagree with it in some way, you are now a trader, right? So it's those sorts of things that I like to explore as well in these things. So
I think both books are quite cinematic. Like I'll speak broadly, so for people who may not have read them, I don't ruin anything, but the tank in the Paris Collaborator is some widescreen action, and in this there's the as you said, that even the flying into Berlin, there's the stuff on the motorbike, there's the denouement, even there's a scene with Duchenne, and it's got the tension of the opening to Inglourious Basterds with Duchenne and someone, and they're knocking on the door. You know, it's I'm speaking as obliquely as possible here, and you know, as I said to you earlier, I really like Duchenne. He's a character that I want to catch up with more. How many more adventures do you think this guy has, A, in you, and B, before he has so many concussions, he's put into protocols? Like, he's taken a beating.
Yeah. I have an idea for another one coming out of this. I kind of couldn't stop myself. Once I started writing the Berlin Trader, I started thinking about other ways we could take this. And as you're doing the research too, it's like you come across these fascinating points in history, or you're reminded of something. So I would like to do something around the Berlin airlift. So, you know, which is when the Soviets surrounded Berlin, because Berlin was in East Germany. And so the Allies couldn't bring in anything on land. So they had to fly these planes. And it was a massive logistic operation to keep West. And they were really trying to strangle the Allies out of West Berlin, so they could have all of Berlin, all of the capital. And when you think about it, with the benefit of hindsight, you're like, well, you must be mad. You're going to put the center, well, not this capital, but you're going to put yourselves surrounded by essentially what then became your enemy in the middle of their territory. Like, it just defies logic. But yeah, so that would be, I think, would be an interesting time in history to set it. But I found also I'm sort of tracking more towards a sort of espionage type novels, in the sense that it'd be harder to tell entirely a detective story, you know, on the street. And more of the sort of dynamics of politics and the sort of backrooms, grey areas of, you know, interpolitical, you know, relationships and everything would be part of it. So I think that's part of it there as well, yeah.
I hope you don't – look, I'm going to make a suggestion of something I'd like to read, which you can A, ignore, and B, if I accidentally touch on anything, we'll just edit this point out, or I'll just keep all of this in and get everyone to forget. But anyway, I'm so into this character. I'd like to see what his reaction to the bomb being dropped is, like the emotional response, because he's such a pacifist that was looming all the way through this story, because we have the knowledge of history that he doesn't experience. So that played a part in, was in my head all the way through. Also, like, I'm really curious about the young fella in World War One. You know, like, what's he like? Mm. Because it's the term back then, it was shell shocked, wasn't it? It wasn't PTSD.
Yes.
So,
shell shocked.
Yeah, I've kind of wondered, man, what was this guy like before he experienced shell shocked? And was there, you know, he seems to have a, you know, we see him saving children. I wondered if he came across children or in some way in World War One. But anyway, I've been thinking heaps about the books.
Now you're giving me ideas. So I think that's, that would be fantastic to put that in. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think that would be a great thing to see. Yeah,
that's what I mean.
Talk.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk some more.
I said I really like him. you know, and I really liked him at the end of the first one. So then when you got in touch and said that he's back, and I was like, oh, great. Well, I want to see what's happening. And that's why I opened the first chapter. I went, what are you doing to my man? Like, Jesus.
Yeah. But I also think that there's also the possibility to introduce, because you have established some other characters around his family, and like even like with his daughter, by the time we get to 19, and this is not a spoiler, but by the time we get to 1945, she's now a journalist. So
yeah.
I thought, well, maybe there's a way to tell from two perspectives, or bring, you know, and have almost like a generational story.
Yeah.
You know? So even if Duchenne becomes sort of more like retired, there's a fantastic series called by Mick Herron writes, Slow Horses is the first, but then they've turned it into an Apple TV series.
Yeah.
And in that, the character has a father that he goes and visits and has all these sort of insights. So Duchenne could be that sort of, you know, sort of more of a sort of venerable sage type character she goes to for advice sort of thing. But that's another idea I was throwing around there sort of thing.
Right, yeah, you could there's so much you can do with the character. I'm looking forward to his retired days in Australia, where he gets embroiled in something that he doesn't want to deal with, called, you know, the Dubbo detective, and he's like, oh, no,
yeah,
I'm
exactly.
here to be retired. But no, I think this whole world is great, and he's a fascinating character. The daughter, you know, like she seems like a perfect product of her mum and dad, and so you know you could end up having like this weirdly militant pacifist, or someone who knows how to engage with violence but feels awful for it while being a journalist. It's there's endless possibilities all the way through. So I think it should be wrapped with where this story is going. If when people read this book and your previous work, are there any movies, TV shows, etc., that you'd recommend for them to check out if they want to stay in this type of world?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I know that there is for the Paris Collaborator. I have not seen this, but I hear it's well regarded. It's called The Village, I think, and it's a story about a collaboration set in, it's a French series set in the village in France. I did start watching a TV series called Shadowlands, which was set in Berlin just after the war, but it wasn't great.
Right.
No, it wasn't Shadowlands. It was Shadow Play. Sorry, excuse me, they used the Joy Division song at the beginning. It wasn't fantastic. But it's set there. I mean, that's just my view. But and it was a big co-pro with like German and American actors, and it was pretty crazy. Had Nina Hoss in it, who's been in a heap of German TV stuff, and they used her in a bunch of American shows whenever they need a sort of German intelligence officer. She's always turning up in that. But but then it had Michael C. Hall. Obviously, Dexter was in it, and Taylor Kitsch. Friday Night Lights, obviously.
Yeah.
Tim Riggins is in it.
Yeah.
It was. They were sort of trying to do that Berlin Babylon kind of thing, but with American cast. Berlin Babylon is great, but that's pre-war, and that's amazing TV series. And a detective story set in Berlin. So those are some ones sort of from a film sort of TV side. In terms of reading, like I mentioned, Mick Herron, just because of the sort of his characters are not heroic in any way.
Yeah.
And so that whole Slow Horses series, which they're about six, that's very contemporary setting though. But they're not like, it's sort of espionage thrillers, but they are not competent in any way. And that's sort of the point of the story.
Yeah.
That's great for that. But I tend to avoid reading other books in the period, fiction books, because I just sort of want to keep my garden clear of other people's stuff. So if I do cross over, I feel ethically okay about the fact that I've sort of crossed it straight into other territory, but I haven't accidentally picked up something that somebody else has done. You know,
That's a tricky one. It's tricky in the world of comedy as well. It's almost like I can't talk about anything that's going on now and see someone else who might be, you know, doing like commenting on stuff. I want my stuff to be definitively through the prism of this idiot rather than, You know, the subconscious picks up on bits and pieces. A quick question about Slow Horses. I only know it from, like, I'd heard of the books, but I know it from the TV series, and I really love the TV series. Do you feel like they're as close as they can be to the experience of the books?
Yeah, they're spot on, but also they've made improvements, I think, that work better for the form of TV. So they've made it a little bit more. In the books, it's very grey, and sometimes the resolutions happen off screen, for want of a better word. So they'll do something, and then you'll find out later on how it resolved. They let the characters actually do those resolutions. It would be very frustrating as a TV viewer to sort of find out, oh, and then 2 days later this thing happened and they weren't anywhere near it.
Yeah.
And so, but you can sort of do that in a book, but you can't really do in a TV where, they've done a really good job of capturing the character, a lot of the character, the essence of the characters, even though the book itself is written from their perspective. So you get a lot of their internal world, so the interiority, as they like to call it in writing, but internal world stuff. And that character, the hacker character, Ronnie Ho, is just such a dislikable but fantastically humorously written character in the books. It's almost worth going back and just reading to see how Heron writes him. I think they've done a fantastic job of adapting it. Obviously, anything with Gary Oldman is worth watching. So,
Oh, mate.
I think. Has he done any stinkers? I'm trying to think of
characters. I don't know. Like, even a stinker is still going to be fun. When he filmed his very small but pivotal part in Oppenheimer, I think that's a wig that he's wearing, because they couldn't making Slow Horses and they had to keep that awful greasy mane that he has, it's a tour de force, and everyone around him is great as well.
Jackson Lamb, it's funny, the almost the first couple of books you think it's going to be, because they like to, when they write it, crime series, they like to name it after the main character, right? And I always thought after the first two books they're going to call it the River Cartwright series, because he's in it so much, right? So he's a sort of point of view character at the first book who turns up and is made to be a slow horse, and that's how you learn about the world of the slow horses. But it's actually the Jackson Lamb series is what they call it now, because he's such a despicable, delikable character. I mean, you get the sense that Mick Herron is just really using him to sort of just be an outlet for sort of ideas that are unpopular, but also a way of writing them in a funny way. And, because of who that character is, he can get away with quite a lot in terms of, and more so in the books than in the TV series, like they rein it in the TV series.
Right.
But he's quite dislikable, like really dislike, but fun dislikable. Like, he's obnoxious, but fun. And funny, they've done a fantastic job with the TV series so far. Those first two seasons are great so far. And I know they're going to do
the third one's coming out in December.
Yeah, actually, I think they shoot them back to back, right?
I
could be wrong about that, but so there might be 3 and 4. I mean, that's probably the only way you can get Gary Oldman, is commit him to.
Yeah, well, it was funny. The first season ended, and there was a trailer for the second. And you're watching, you watch it, you get to the end of the first, and the way TV is now these days, you're like, oh, I hope I get another season. Oh, I am. There's a trailer.
Yeah,
this
exactly.
is great. So,
no question hanging out. Will it be picked up for a second series?
This is great.
Exactly.
I think Gary Oldman said he'd be quite happy if this is his final role. Like, if he just kept making new series, he'd be wrapped. And poor River, I love River. He's kind of like the anti James Bond, who he's just doing his best and he desperately wants to be the guy. And Jack Loudon's so just likable, the first thing I'd seen him in was Dunkirk, and I immediately was won over to him as an actor when he gets pulled out of the plane and he has that very English, good evening as he's pulled out. And I want this guy to succeed. So I bring that into Slow Horses and he's just a bit fucking useless. It's great. Yeah.
No, it is a great series.
So thank you for chatting to me and the listeners today. Where is the best place for people to pick up The Berlin Trader?
Well, it's out in bookstores for those who want the physical copy. There's obviously ebooks are available through all the usual places. And then not quite yet, but in the next coming weeks, the audiobook will also be out via Audible, Belinda, all the usual places, through your library listening apps or whatever.
Are you reading it?
Mm. No. They get a professional reader of audiobooks to do it. But it's so impressive what they're able to do, how quickly they're able to turn around and be spot on with the words on the page. It's a real art. And also then to sort of bring an interpretation, because I don't imagine they spend hours and hours and hours, you know, figuring out how they're going to play each scene like you would in a TV show or film. They just do it on the fly and do such a good job of it. Stephen Pering is the guy who read the first and will now be reading the sequel, the Berlin Traitor as well.
Oh, that's great. That's exciting. Yeah. Well, when this third book is ready to come out, you got to let us know and come back. You should be really wrapped with this one. I love the first one.
Thanks, Justin.
And, mate, it's, as I said, I'm happy to catch up with this guy for as long as he can be gaffered together and keep his wits about him. So congratulations. Where can people find you on the socials?
I'm on Instagram, Alex Hammond Author. That's about it. I think everything else is going sideways very quickly, right, in terms of socials.
Yeah, it really is. And, I think about 6 or 7 years ago, I looked at TikTok and went, you know what, I can hear the natural TikTok of life enough. And I decided I was happy to not be across it. So I'm pretty much Instagram as well, so they can find you there.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. And let's chat again soon.
Yeah, thanks, Justin. Great to chat.
Thanks to Alex for joining me today, and please check out his novel if you can. Look, selling books is a tough game, and I'd love to read more about this character. And I think once you have a taste of it, I think you'll want more of this character as well. So, look, it's coming up to October already. Christmas is just around the corner. So even if you don't buy the book for yourself, maybe it might make a good Christmas present for someone you know who enjoys well-written thrillers. But I loved it and can't wait to have Alex back on to discuss more in the future. Life is all over the shop for me at the moment. I don't think that is anything new for anyone at this point of the year. So I'm not quite certain when the next season of Big Squid will be back, but hopefully there'll be at least a couple of little specials here and there to keep you going. If you feel like you're missing out on the Big Squid community, there's still episodes going up on Patreon. Where you can catch up with me and all of the people there. You can find us at patreon.com/Justin Hamilton. That's patreon.com/Justin Hamilton. You'll find a tier that suits you. We're about to do a Patreon-only long-form story, which has been promised for a month. I've got to be honest. It's still on the way, but it's very close to finally being recorded. And yeah, I think you'll be up for that. That'll be fun. As I said, there's just been a few little things going on that I reckon I'll be able to talk about in the future. I'm good, but a lot of stressful things going on around me. And I'm back at the chase, and Question Everything is coming up soon. So we're in pre-production for that and doing stand-up. And yes, something had to give. Something had to give. And then I turned 51, and I'll tell you what gave there. It was my hope of ever taking a good photo again. Anyway, we'll save that for a discussion another time. Great to be back in your ears. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please go and check out The Berlin Traitor by A.W. Hammond. And I thought today we could finish with a quote about thrillers. It's from Daniel Craig, and it really sort of fits the character of August Deschenes, who is Alex's main guy. I found this quote and I went, yep, this sums up this poor character. Daniel Craig says, "The worst situation you can have in a thriller is a lead who looks like he can handle himself." Ah, Deschenes, he can barely handle himself, and that's what makes those books so unstoppable. All right. Thanks for listening in, and I look forward to chatting with you again soon. Until then.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.